don't have time to totally get into it, so I apologize for that. That's normal. It's normal to be nervous and normal to be scared, but you're going to make new friends and you're going to learn new stuff.
Yes, yes. And if you don't, there's always one other person who's also an outsider, so you can be friends with them.
Yeah.
That was always my thing. Like, who doesn't have a friend? I'll go make friends with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe we can do a show on how to make friends.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah.
All right. We are running up on our time limit here today. Thank you so much for listening. This has been The Gap. I'm Althea. Tammy's here. Sonia is engineering for us. Thank you, Sonia. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Check us out online, kbu.fm/thegap. Follow us on Instagram @thegapradio. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great weekend and take care.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, KBOO members. It's time once again to vote and make your voices heard. KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election is coming up on Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. KBOO members are invited to participate in a lively discussion on how to reconnect KBOO's diverse communities after 18 months of the pandemic, the role of radio in the 21st century, and the upcoming celebration of our 54th anniversary. KBOO depends on its members to help shape its operations and programming. So show your support by casting your vote and joining this community forum. Be sure to check your mailbox for your ballot and voting information. If you don't receive your ballot in the mail by September 13th, please contact the membership department or vote online at kbu.fm. Ballots cast by mail must be received by Friday, September 24th. The deadline to vote electronically is September 19th and will reopen during the annual meeting in lieu of voting in person. If you are not a member, you can become one today by going to kbu.fm and clicking the Join Now button. Again, that's KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election on Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information about the annual meeting, candidate bios, and online voting forms can be found at kbu.fm/meeting2021. That's kbu.fm/meeting2021.
Nearly 50 years ago, a Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, struck down abortion restrictions across the U.S. 6 out of 9 justices are now conservatives. They will hear an abortion case from Mississippi in 2022. From January through June 2021, 19 states passed 94 laws restricting abortions, including 12 bans. They are eager for Supreme Court support. On Wings, here is Dorothy Fetterman's documentary, When Abortion Was Illegal.
I was 17 years old. I was married. And 10 months after I was married, I had a baby girl. She was very ill, very jaundiced, and the doctor told me, the OBGYN who had delivered her, told me that if I ever had another child, I would die. 3 months later, I was pregnant again, and I was absolutely terrified. So I went back to him and I said, am I pregnant? And he said, yes. And he said, I told you not to get pregnant. And I said, but you didn't tell me how not to.
I thought we were pretty close. I mean, we had talked about getting married, we had talked about babies, we had talked about what we would name a child. And when I got pregnant and said, I'm pregnant, everything changed. It was like, well, whose is it? And that was such a shock to me that the relationship ended.
And there was this whole kind of thing, we had to keep it an absolute secret. And it was a humiliating, strange kind of experience. And so I decided I should have an abortion. I didn't know what it would be. I didn't really understand the implications in the fact that it was illegal. So I said, well, it was just like it would make this problem go away.
When abortion was illegal, untold stories. Until the mid-1800s, abortions were legal and available in the United States. Both the state and the church permitted abortions if they occurred before quickening, when the mother first perceived fetal movement. In 1847, the newly formed American Medical Association began a campaign to professionalize medicine by outlawing what it called quackery. Included in its ban were midwives and herbalists who had provided abortion and maternity care in their communities for centuries. During the second half of the 19th century, Victorian society began to condemn women seeking abortions as selfish, immoral, and shirking the duty of motherhood. Protestant and Catholic churches joined the medical establishment in expressing their condemnation. Meanwhile, legislation restricting abortion continued to spread, and by the turn of the century, both birth control and abortion were illegal in most states. If a woman needed medical treatment after a botched abortion, she faced a humiliating and dangerous situation. Even though infected and bleeding, she was often required to testify against her husband or lover and the abortionist before she could receive medical care.
Believing I am about to die, make this my antemortem statement. I became acquainted with John Schockweiler. I had sexual intercourse with him, and in the month of May, I noticed that I was pregnant.
I, Cora Alice Grimes, about to die, make this statement. On the second day of July, 1896, James Dunn, a retail merchant, gave me a packet of calomel. I took two doses of the calomel.
I, Rulette Parker, am about to die. I went to visit Dr. Parker.
Well into the 20th century, a climate of fear prevailed.
I went to medical school in New York City in the 50s when abortions were illegal, and every day the city hospital that my medical school staffed would have 20 or 30 women come in infected and bleeding and dying from abortions that they had induced themselves, and the coat hanger trick was used, and or they had a friend that had a catheter and they'd leave the catheter in until for a day or two, and she was bleeding and cramping, and they'd come in, and that's not an exaggeration. I think it was true in any major city area in this country in the 50s.
When we got them, we received them like with a temperature of 105. Bleeding, totally infected. We had some die in shock because they did not tell the truth, and they was afraid to tell the truth as to what had happened. They knew it was illegal, and they felt like we were only getting the information to report them to the police. It's like, turn me in. That I aborted myself. They was just plain housewives who felt like, I can't afford another child.
I couldn't have that baby, because if I did and I died, who would take care of the little baby I had? And so I asked the young women where I worked at a Walgreens drugstore, and I asked them if there was somebody who could help me do something. You didn't say the word abortion in those days. And they knew what I wanted. And they sent me to a woman, and she told me that she would do it for $50. This was in 1939, and $50 was a lot of money. Then I sold everything I had that I could get a few pennies for, and I eventually got my $50, and I went out to see this woman. And she put, I think it was a strip of slippery elm bark, and she inserted this up my uterus. And she said, now you go home, and that will swell up, and you will have pain, and you will probably have some temperature, but you will have a miscarriage. 2 days later, I had a screaming fever, and I was in such pain. And I went back out to see this woman, and she lived in a shack, and she met me at the door, and she said, I told you not to come back. And I said, I have nowhere else to go. And so she cleaned me up, and I was so frightened, and I was in tears. And she put her arms around me like that, and she just held me up to her chest for a minute, and she said, honey, did you think it was so easy to be a woman? I'll never forget that. Never forget the kindness of that woman, even under those terrible circumstances. And so she said, this time you go. She gave me some aspirin. She said, don't you ever come back again. And that was the last I saw of her. And I had a roaring fever for about 3 or 4 days, and then I got better. And I went back to see my doctor when I got the money for the visit. And I told him, I said I had something done. And he said, well, I figured a smart kid like you would figure a way out of it. And I looked at him then, and I thought, how could he? How could he? This was a man trained and licensed, and he turned me away. And I had to go out and find this woman to do this. And it was to save my very own life.
The day came, and they took me to a motel several miles from Boise. It was a dirty motel. And I was alone with this woman, and I remember what she looked like really well. She was dirty too. And not friendly, really divorced from the proceedings. And she gave me a cervical puncture, and I remember the steel tool, you know. And then she told me to go, and that there would be blood, but it would be all right. But the fact is that I didn't abort, and I just bled a lot, and it was incredibly painful, and I got a bad infection. And they started looking for a doctor because I just kept bleeding and bleeding and not aborting. And finally they found a doctor. He gave me some medication to make me abort. And I aborted at home so that if he were caught, he would be able to prove that the process had been initiated before he became involved. And he explained that to me, that he wanted to be able to help other women who found themselves in my position, and that the only way he could protect himself was that. And so that was, I had to do that alone.
I didn't tell anyone except the father. And when I saw his reaction, I didn't tell anyone else. I just thought, well, this is my problem, and I'll have to deal with it. And the only thing I could do was to get an abortion, because to have a baby without a husband just was not done. I just went to the telephone directory, and I looked up obstetricians, gynecologists, and I looked for a gynecologist that didn't advertise as an obstetrician, and I thought maybe he would be most sympathetic, and it turned out he was.
Researchers have interviewed doctors who were in medical practice when abortion was illegal.
There were many physicians who were supportive of abortion, who felt it should be available and provided safely for women. But they were afraid to do them themselves. Sometimes the fear was because they didn't want to be found out or would be censured. But very often, their fear was, and rightly, I think, that as soon as word got out that they were willing to do abortions, they would be flooded with requests. One of the doctors who started off thinking he would do a few abortions found himself getting referrals of women from all over the United States. In 1965, he began to do abortions for women referred to him by ministers. Over the course of the next 8 years, he did thousands of abortions.
I began to realize how difficult it was to obtain the service, how desperately women needed it and wanted it, and to what lengths they would go to obtain it, even to readily risking their life. People talk about as though women didn't know that. That didn't matter. Women risk their life every day to get an abortion somewhere in this country. Many of them did, without hesitation.
And I just really literally walked up and down the streets. I was by myself, and I would go from one place to another, and they would all be in the same situation. They would say, nobody's there, I don't know what you're talking about, and oh, they've moved away. Finally, one day, I heard of a place, nobody answered the phone, but I got in the car and I went there and I knocked on the door, sort of after hours, like evening, early evening. I was the only one there. He did not give me anything. There was no anesthesia at all. And it was very painful, and I had no idea it was supposed to be painful. I thought maybe was doing something terrible to me. And so it was a frightening experience. That was frightening.
Throughout the years of criminal abortion, an aura of danger surrounded unwanted pregnancies. Women drank toxic substances. Unscrupulous practitioners administered caustic douches of Lysol and Clorox. Reports of rape and other sexual abuse by abortionists were common. This obstetrician describes what she remembers.
At that time, shotgun marriages were in vogue, and there were all these youngsters getting married, which never solved anything. It only made the matters worse. The marriages never lasted. The children suffered, and it was a miserable situation. And then we went through the period when we were sending girls to homes for the unwed mothers. They were all over the country, and they were expected to work part-time and give up their child for adoption. And that was a very sad situation, because you would see a young woman come in, and if she was a school girl, she would have to go off, leave home, and everyone knew why, and her life was really wrecked socially and academically and everything else. And it was the young that really got to me, seeing some of these youngsters, 12, 13, 14, their mothers would bring them in, and it was just a horrible thing.
As public awareness grew about the consequences of illegal abortion, lawmakers and clergy joined with the medical establishment in pressing for reforms. In states where therapeutic abortions were permitted, some doctors were lenient so they could provide more women with safe abortions.
I heard about these two co-eds in Stanford who went to Tijuana and obtained illegal abortions. The first was a girl who came back with septicemia and who subsequently died. The second came back and had a severe infection of her reproductive organs, and it was necessary to do a hysterectomy, which rendered her sterile, of course. At the same time, there was in existence in California a law which allowed for medical support with an abortion on non-medical grounds, namely through a psychiatric channel. We would use these channels in order to enable the girl or woman to get a therapeutic abortion. Why did I do this? It was outrage at the way in which women were being treated, whether there was a reaction of the boyfriend or fiancé or husband. Some of these responses were grotesque. Some men told the women that if I'd known you were so stupid, I wouldn't have gone with you in the first place. Others told the girl that it's her problem, she's got the baby, he doesn't have anything to do with it. A good number of them just took off, just had no response whatsoever. So where do women who are desperate get help?
There were many of us out there who were looking desperately for some place to solve the problem. So I began to listen. You tune in, you know, you get sensitive to it, and you begin to hear things that give you a clue, and you pursue it a little bit and find out that somebody did have an abortion. And I just got the names of the doctors, and I would just give the names. A young woman would call on the phone, someone I didn't know, and would ask for help. And that they were feeling so desperate that they were calling strangers. I was aware that what I was doing was illegal. I guess I think what was going to happen to them was worse than the possibility of what might happen to me.
People who themselves had had to search for an abortion understood the difficulty in finding one. When Russ was 19, he and his girlfriend realized she was pregnant.
I was terrified at the prospect of being a father, and I went to my assistant track coach, a young guy, very friendly and stuff, and I told him. And he said, find out more about it, what do you want to do, and so forth. And I began to ask around about possibilities of her getting an abortion, and I talked to her about it. And she didn't want to be a mother either. First off, there was some misbegotten effort, I don't know where it originated or how it happened, to get some kind of pills that would induce an abortion, and they didn't work. Finally, I get a name of someone actually in town, in Los Angeles, who's willing to do this and get a price. And my assistant coach gave me the money.
Years after his own experience, Russ had a chance to help someone else.
I was approached by a senior professor, a woman, who had a student, and she was pregnant. Did I, by any chance, have any information on where she might get an abortion? Well, it's interesting. I didn't hesitate. I got a name of someone highly confident that this was a good clinic in Tijuana, and she got the abortion. Well, I saw her 2 years ago, and she came up to me and she thanked me. That was nice. It felt a little bit like saving a life.
Lola Huth was the lead dancer of the Jose Limon Dance Company. She was married and the mother of a baby girl when she died from a self-induced abortion.
At the time of my sister's death, I was told she died in childbirth, but that didn't make any sense. Then I was told it was a miscarriage, that she bled to death. The story came to me in bits and pieces over many years.
Even though she was using an IUD for birth control, Lola became pregnant. A doctor told her that the IUD would probably cause the baby to be deformed, but that removing it might cause a miscarriage. Lola weighed the risks carefully and decided to have the IUD removed.
She went back for the scheduled appointment, and he said, I'm sorry, I have consulted with colleagues, and I cannot do anything that could implicate me in an illegal act. Right now, the whole abortion issue is very, very hot and very controversial, and I just can't implicate myself. And she said, well, then I'm inclined to believe I will do it myself. And he said, all right, well, I'll tell you what to do. I'll tell you how to do it. And when you're in the process of miscarriage, you can call me, you can go to the hospital, and then I'll be able to help you without jeopardizing my own position. So that was her plan.
When removing the IUD didn't cause a miscarriage, Lola became desperate. She sought a way to end the pregnancy herself.
She purchased a couple of plastic tubes. And what she was told to do was insert these tubes into the cervix and blow air into the cervix, and that would cause her to abort. So she filed a sharp point and had punctured a vein and got air into her bloodstream.
When we realized I was pregnant again, I told my mother. She asked me if I wanted another abortion, and I said no. I couldn't stand the idea of doing that again.
Rosalie had been raped by an older man. She was afraid that another illegal abortion would lead to the same medical complications as before, so she decided to go to a home for unwed mothers and then give the baby up for adoption.
Everyone told me that if I had any sense, I wouldn't look at the baby. I would just let them take it away and I'd never look at the baby, but I did. I let them bring the baby to me and I held the baby. That was a terrible mistake. And then I owed some money for my board and room and medical. And so I stayed for a while and I worked in the nursery to work the money off. And that was a very bad mistake because I was just around babies all the time. And I actually held a baby before they took it. Oh, God.
And anybody who would think that'd be a great way to solve the problem is just... I mean, you take a child who doesn't even know her own mind, a 17-year-old young woman, and ask her to carry a baby in her body for 9 months and then give birth to it and then just give it away like it's nothing.
It's very difficult, even after 40 years, to admit to doing something that was against the law, that was illegal. It sort of puts you in the position of having a criminal past. And although you might not feel that what you did was in any way criminal, there's still the stigma to it. But it's a relief to be able to talk about it after all these years and say, hey, I was human.
I knew that I could lose my medical license. I knew that I could go to prison. And just as I had to trust these women who came to me not to bring charges against me, which could put me in prison, they had to trust me to give them good medical care and service and not harm them. And that was a scary thing in those days, because you didn't know who you were going to, you didn't know what the outcome was going to be. It was frightening for women to come from great distances to a little town in East Texas to some unknown doctor. They came by bus, by train, by car, and they had to trust that they were going to leave there intact and alive.
A woman that's unhappily pregnant will risk her life to stop that particular pregnancy. And then later in her life, when conditions have changed, she will happily risk her life to have a child. This is the same woman.
And I was saying to my mother, you know, we have to talk about this. It's important. We can't, when you're in conversation with people, you tell them that your daughter died giving herself an abortion. We have to all start telling these stories. You know, that it isn't just some anonymous person that nobody knows who's had an abortion, but people right next to us in our community, in our lives, and some of them don't survive.
When Abortion Was Illegal, Untold Stories was produced and directed by Dorothy Fadiman. Adaptation for radio, Frieda Worden, Women's International News Gathering Service. Associate producer, videographer, and editor, Daniel Myers. Music, Etika Luckett. Production team, Beth Seltzer, Nyla Bogue, Blake McHugh, and Phyllis Cole. Narrator, Dorothy Fadiman. Executive producer, Danny McGuire, KTEH-TV, San Jose. When Abortion Was Illegal was funded by the Wallace Alexander Gribody Foundation, Melinda Maxfield, Tom Peters, and more than 100 individuals.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose latest events can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement, all one word, .org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
Good morning, Allison. Would you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, John. My name is Allison Fleur Barber, and I am a resident of Portland, Oregon. I experience cerebral palsy and I'm a quadriplegic who relies on in-home care through Aging and Disability Services. I have an exception rate, which means I get more hours of care than the average person because of my exceptional needs. And so I get 8 hours of care, or 9 hours of care a day. Mm-hmm. So 5 hours in the morning and 4 hours at night.
How has the caregiver workforce crisis impacted you?
Well, let's see. In June, one of my long-term providers had to leave the position. I put out an ad, but it wasn't getting any bites. And I started to talk with my friends in the community, and they were saying that they were experiencing similar times, and they have been going for multiple months without responses to their ads or significant staffing to meet their needs. And this had been going on for some people, they had said 8 months. For some people, they said a full year. And most of them cited the low income or the low wages and the low amount of hours that they were each allotted.
And you did say that you had posted an advertisement for this. I'm just a little curious, where does one post an advertisement? I mean, if somebody was looking for a potential job in this field, where might they find these advertisements?
So usually it is in Craigslist under gig employment or et cetera. Or healthcare jobs. The problem with Craigslist is that there are a million posts for caregiving, and it's all very generic. Like, you're only allowed to put a very generic title in for your caregiving, so there's nothing really to differentiate yourself from other listings, and there's about a million listings, so it's hard to get bites on from the public on your ads on Craigslist. The other places I posted in the past are places like Indeed, which is more expensive, but you can also post at colleges on their job boards through their employment departments or their job search departments for their students.
So then there is like no posting through the state that you can do to like maybe get on some kind of list or something like that?
Can post onto the home care registry, and we are there's a current ad up for my needs on the registry, but that as of yet has had no feedback from anyone. Also, when people are getting responses, I've heard from plenty of people that they have gotten responses, but then a person agrees to interview but doesn't show up for the interview, or shows up for the interview and says okay to the job but doesn't show up for the job. So that's part of what's happening too out there.
And that could be a real problem for somebody who's on a ventilator.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, this kind of brings up another question. Isn't there like an on-call substitute list that can be accessed in some way?
There's not. There is no way for me without using my own devices to, I should be able to call a case manager and have my case manager access some kind of on-call list and able to get somebody out to me. That is not at play in the aging and disability services end of things. It is not at play on the DD side of things, as far as I understand.
You're so, absolutely right on that one.
Yeah.
I've had mines up for ever and a day.
Yeah. I think that one of the problems with the crisis is that the burden of finding staffing is placed on the person with the disability who, if they're in the middle of a staffing crisis, could have real functional barriers, you know, or real issues even getting on the phone and connecting with the person. If they're stuck in bed, as I would be, right? You can't access the phone to call anybody or to advocate for yourself in a really real way when your basic needs and health are not being addressed first.
Mm-hmm. This sounds like a serious crisis. People on the intellectually disabled side are able to access PSWs and DSPs. But mm-hmm. from what I understand, people with physical disabilities can only access home care workers. Am I correct on that?
Mm-hmm. One of the major ways we could fix the system is to standardize the rates of pay, benefits, and titles for the staff that we're using across the board if there's a disability with need for home care workers. On the aging and disability side, the worker is called a home care worker, or HCW. There is a different pay structure for the home care worker. I believe for home care workers it is very much less than they would get than working for the DD side. So that is a disincentive to come work for us, but also an incentive for working for, as a home care worker for the aging and disability side, is you get the medical coverage. You get the the access to the extended Medicaid that they give to workers. So that is the plus, is the medical care. The minus is the lower rate of pay. What would make it a lot easier for people to cover everyone's need is to provide uniform rates of pay and benefit levels across the board.
Do you think that the reason why they keep the physical caregivers different than the mentally disabled caregivers different is to keep the two sides separate so that we're too busy fighting each other rather than going after the state or federal government and actually getting caregivers on equal ground so that we can actually get an equal amount of caring that we need to maintain our lives?
I do feel like it creates a little bit of infighting, and also my needs should supersede the other. But I don't believe it was built because of that, to create that. I think it was built because in some way, compensation rate for developmental or intellectual tasks is somehow perceived as being more work, so that the pay is better for developmental disabilities versus physical disabilities. When kind of I don't think you can compare apples to oranges. You really can't. And I think that there's a lot of really hard physical work that people have to do on the aging and physical disability side. With me, for example, I'm a quadriplegic. It's, you know, very physically demanding work. And I think that a pay rate should not be even a question, you know, part of the bargaining chip. It should just be solidly one rate.
So I was aware that it was HB 2964 that had gone down to defeat. Now, true enough, this would have only affected direct support professionals, which are on the intellectually disabled side, but it may have been a start to actually giving some stability within the larger community. You know, like if the direct support professionals have a standard wage, why in the world don't the home care workers have one and the PSWs have one as well? And, you know, that particular defeat, I think kind of like, I think it not only shot people with intellectually disabilities in the foot, it shot kind of like maybe everybody with a disability in the foot, because this would have been a foothold in which we could have said, okay, we got this side now stabilized, now let's work on this side.
Yeah, I think the main point that we need to, like, one of the main changes we need to make is we don't need to mix sides anymore. Everything needs to be on the same level playing field. And once it is, we can start advocating for better pay rates and universal health coverage at different hours that people are working. It just needs to be one playing field. That's one of the major issues. Because you're right, probably the fact that it came down to defeat on the DD side will mean it will also come, something similar will come up for the aging and disability side and be summarily rejected. Because of how that was treated on the DD side. That's how that works. Yeah. So it comes down to, first of all, I don't think that the pay rate on either side is equitable to the work that someone is doing. When you're looking at nursing wages, you're looking at people that are making $20 to $25 starting per hour. And unfortunately, that is a huge lift for the state to do, but that would only be the time in which we are able to attract people to the jobs that we are offering. We're not able to do that right now at the current rate of pay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to kind of clarify some differences between the services that those with a physical disability can get versus those with an intellectual disability can get.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, you are not able, I mean, if you had some kind of social anxiety or some difficulty getting out there and being around people and stuff like that, you're not able to actually get some kind of service that can help you out with that. Do I have that correct?
Well, I think that the people that come from the physical and disability side, they're just the folks that don't qualify for based on IQ. So that is everybody else. So the aging and disability side catches everyone with a normal IQ who has limitations in other ways. That's mental health, that is physical, and that is aging. So we have people that are working as home care workers that are working with people that are profoundly mentally ill and providing those kinds of supports to connect them to their communities, to help them get out to do errands, to keep them calm and able to connect to their community. So that's happening with the aging and disability services. But is it happening well? That's debatable, right? There's no specific, I look at the DD system and the aging and disability services system because I work, I've worked largely within the DD system as a professional. What I see is a lot more wraparound supports, people that you can go to and say, hey, I need this change in my plan. If this is not working, we need to change this goal on the my ISP or whatever they're calling it now. What are they calling it now? They're calling
you can call it, I have a certain term for it, and I don't think I can say it across the air, unfortunately. But yes, I do believe we call it an ISP.
Mm-hmm. So
the Individual Service Plan, I would like to state that an ISP is not where a person with an intellectual disability gets their hours from.
Mm-hmm.
So many clients get confused on that. They think ISP is where I get my hours from. No, it is not. You get your hours from your assessments.
Okay, thank you for that, because it's been a while and I know that, the assessments and all the different names have changed. So I just wanted to make sure I was saying the right thing. When we're talking about the DD system, I think that there is a lot more wraparound supports that one can access. You've got your case manager, you've got your care coordinators in a lot of cases. And then you've got your direct support staff. So you've literally got a tree of people. On the aging and disability side, aside from your annual, which looks at your needs and looks at your financial eligibility for Medicaid to continue, right? Those are the two things that looks at. Based on that, that's the only support you get from the person, from your case manager. All the other stuff is supposed to go through the Home Care Commission. The Home Care Commission is who is supposed to be talking to you about your needs, and giving you a reference list of people that are looking for work. I personally hired off of that reference list and had people come and do no-shows. I've had people come and show up for one shift and actually steal my door code and door key and knock them back and drop off the face of the earth. So the Home Care Commission is really falling down on a lot of things, including providing a referral list that actually has people ready and willing to work in your area with your needs. Also, there's no base training on needs. So they're only serving people that are highly verbal and good at communicating what their needs are and how and can self-train, because there's not a lot of training out there for somebody on all the different conditions that come through aging and disability services. So if you're verbal and can have the patients to self-direct your care and show people what you need done, then you're in good shape. If you're not that person, then you're in bad shape under the system.
So in other words, just being a person with an intellectual disability, I am aware that there are two case entities that can serve to help you advocate for what you want, which is either a county case manager
mm-hmm.
with caseloads somewhere as high as, what is it, 80, 70 people? Yes, very high caseload.
Yeah.
Or you can have a brokerage, which has a much lower caseload, but in my opinion, still a very high caseload, anywhere from, I think it's from 36 to 42
mm-hmm.
on the caseload.
Yeah.
So these are the agent, or these are the people, and yes, you're right, we do interact with them, at least when we want to. We don't always do this. But when we want to, we can interact with them more often probably than you would interact with the person who's helping you coordinate your care,
mm-hmm.
which it sounds like is the Home Care Commission.
Yes. My case manager, the main things my case manager does is he's the money guy. He's the one that's making sure that people are reporting their hours, that I am signing off on those hours and that those hours are correct. And those are hours that they're actively working for me. That is the guy. He is the bean counter, basically. He basically tells me, you know, how many hours I have and make sure that the people that I'm working are getting paid. That's all that they do. And any other concerns about staffing are really out of their purview. They don't seem to have a lot of advocacy around getting someone in when people are in need of staffing.
So that's pretty much just left up entirely to you to find your own people. And if there's nobody out there, you could be in a lot of, you could just be laying in bed until somebody comes along.
Right. So the way I view it is case management on the aging and disability side is like an accountant who's taking care of your hours and doing a lot of math and making sure the checks are going out and people are getting paid, but they're not providing any support for your health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
By making sure that you have the staffing that's adequate.
So it does sound like you all need to be able to be a part of brokerages as well.
Mm-hmm. I would advocate for that, yes. I have had, you know, I have cerebral palsy, but I also have a mental health condition. So I always have to defer to my husband often to do some of this work when it's too stressful for me because I don't feel good because I'm not clean or I haven't had my full care, to put the demand on me to then advocate for my own needs and get new people in and sell myself and seem like a good person to work for. It's a little bit of a tall order. So mm-hmm. I've relied on other staff members to help me with my own staff recruitment. I've allowed my husband when it gets too stressful to put messages out to the group to ask for coverage when I don't need it. Because I'm not, for being a person who has a pretty high need, I don't like to ask for help. So that's a big, and I share this because I don't think I'm alone in this struggle. I think a lot of people which I think the IQ rule is misguided as well. I think the IQ rule should be done away with because the federal law says that anyone with a disability prior to the age of 20 or 18 has a developmental disability. So that would do away with the IQ component entirely.
And can I just say one thing? That's only if your parents were wise enough to get poking around in the service and get you that diagnosis before you turned 18.
Right. And there's been some talk about retroactively saying someone was if they're diagnosed after age 18, like saying that this was present at birth by a doctor, like that's assessing them at 30, right? Saying that this was at place from birth. So those are in talks. But you know, any way we can do with it with the IQ notion is also a barrier to services. Because it's putting people into pots and it's not helping, you know, into categories, and it's not helping with the services either. And we could all use, because our needs, our basic living needs all need to be met. We all need that support to be able to get staffing in, because there's gonna be points when all of us, regardless of how mentally stable or our IQ level, will need support to speak up for our own needs and advocate for our own best interests. Mm-hmm. I think the fear is that the case management system will become overreaching and start speaking for us the way the institutions did in the past. So that would be, there would be have to be a healthy medium of like trying to figure out when they're reaching too far into our lives and taking away our abilities to speak for ourselves.
Or just taking away our humanity?
Yeah, or humanity, right. So there has to be a fine line to walk, but I think everyone deserves a degree of support in managing and finding their own care.
You know, you're bringing up some very good points. How do you think we should start advocating for all this? I mean, obviously we've been advocating and telling, you know, legislators this on so many levels and on a constant basis. And yet it does seem like every time we see a bit of light on the horizon, they shoot it down. How would you suggest that we advocate for something like this when it does seem like those we vote in to represent us aren't listening to us at all.
Well, I think you have to go back and realize that America is the only industrialized nation without universal health coverage to understand the basis of that ill. So I'm a huge proponent for universal health care, and we still need to push for that in however many years it takes for us to get. In the interim, we can fight for a higher wage and for medical coverage for all healthcare workers. Even those who work on the DD side need to get enrolled in basic medical.
Perhaps some benefits as well?
Oh yeah.
This is just, I'm aware that there's a union around home care workers and PSWs. But when it comes to the DSPs, they do not have a union. They might get a slightly higher wage, but they don't necessarily have the benefits that the union gives.
Yeah. So what I was saying is, like, everyone needs healthcare across the board. So mm-hmm. we won't move this by moving a mountain where we talk about all of the issues at once. We have to tackle this kind of in silos, one issue at a time, to get some traction. So raise the wage for DSPs and personal support workers on the DD side.
Yeah.
Raise the wage for people with the aging and disability side to be commensurate with that. Because both of them need a raise into like the 20 to 25 range. Now that's gonna be a huge push, because that asks for state funding to be way higher, which is something they don't like to do.
From what I understand, the state often has this slosh effect when it comes to funding. And no offense, if they can slosh around $1 billion or maybe $100 million, I don't know anybody else who could do this, then certainly within that sloshiness, they could find the money to increase people's wages.
Yeah, that definitely needs to happen. I think we are considering it a class action, bringing class action and figuring out who's going to support that. So we'll see where that goes. And legal support, yeah.
So, well, I have discussed this so many times with so many other people. It's not just mm-hmm. you who's been in this kind of crisis, but I actually had a meeting with a director over this particular crisis, and they were saying that they've had actually several people come in and say, we're in the same boat. We can't get caregivers in, and our person needs caregivers. One of the things that popped up is, why couldn't we bring a class action suit underneath the Staley Act? If there isn't a workforce, then you're not, you know, doing what you said you were going to do with the Staley Act, which was to provide services. Mm-hmm. I do believe it was mostly on the intellectually disabled side, but maybe we can also bring along those with physical disabilities and really get in there and make the state start taking a look at things.
I think so, because right now we have people actively having declining health due to this crisis that are actively, you know, having higher incidence in their of mental health crisis due to this crisis, and people who are at risk of dying currently who are in this crisis. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel like we can fix it.
Yeah, and I gotta say, I am all for universal health care. Come on, let's just do universal health care, all right?
If there's any tag to this episode, it's let's get universal health care in America.
Yeah, that, and we also have a caregiver crisis. So, Allison, I would like to thank you for coming into the studio and telling us about, how this is impacting you.
Thank you for having me. Well, John, I'm so glad you have this platform. It's very important. Thank you for doing it.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kbu.org.
are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Phil G. I'm one of the hosts of KBOO's Grateful Dead and Friends show, Saturdays from noon to 2. All through August,